Hey everybody, Kevin Pennell, host of the Hope is Not a Plan podcast. This is part two, some of the truths about the nuclear power industry from my dad's perspective. We recorded this initially in June 2023. If you're on YouTube, thank you for watching. If you're in podcast land, thanks for listening. This is a great discussion. We get some more insight of what it was like for my dad to transition from the submarine service of the Navy to the private sector and public sector as he worked for both private industry and some government doing nuclear power. And we get some truths about nuclear power, not just propaganda or naysaying that often happened in the news, particularly in the 70s and 80s when he was coming up through the industry. And we learn a bit about human factors, how we can make processes and technology better by studying how people use these objects. So thank you all for hitting play, for watching this on YouTube. You'll see some advertisements for Kev Talks podcast. It's now Hope is Not a Plan podcast. Please go to hopesnotaplan.com for more to hear part one of this great interview and discussion, to learn more, to learn how to care for your end of life patient, which my dad was up to a couple weeks ago when he passed away, and what it's like to deal with that. It's tough. It's tough to see someone die, to see them ailing. But that's where, as I talked about, we can look at those seven pillars of how do we own this and how do we practice our mindfulness somehow and still get that movement, set boundaries with what we're comfortable with, make those connections or reestablish them with our family so we can be the best caregiver possible, focus on sleep because we have to rest so we can be there for others, and have some faith in something bigger than yourself. Thank you. I have faith in you all for watching, for sharing, subscribing, and just for learning. And I hope this helps. If it helps one person, and I've heard that it has, then I'll keep doing it. And thank you so much for keeping hitting play. Godspeed, everybody. Done your service in the Navy. You've gotten out. You work for Virginia Power, which is awesome. I think this is just a little before I was born still. Nace was born. But now you're at Virginia Power. But before we get into, because you have so much experience in the nuclear industry now, 50 years or so, is to provide both me and the listeners some basics, right? So to start with, can you just touch on, like, what is nuclear power? When we hear that term, what does that mean?
Yeah, let me explain it in a way, kind of differentiate. First of all electric power is generated the same way in terms of when you heat water to make steam. Okay. Mm-hmm. So the biggest difference is if you're burning coal or burning anything, you have a big building full of tubes. The flame, whatever the source is, gas, coal, is inside this big building. There's a bunch of tubes that run up and down the walls of the building. They heat the water, turn it to steam, goes to the turbine, makes electricity. You pump the water back through the tubes again to make steam again, and so on. So the difference between that and a nuclear reactor is it's a different heat source. It doesn't burn anything. Fission is a process where you split atoms, and you do it at such a high rate that the rods in the core that have uranium pellets in them generate heat.
Okay.
So you pump water through that core. It goes in the bottom, picks up maybe 60 degrees from the bottom to the top, goes to what we call steam generators, which is like a big tea kettle. So the primary coolant that goes through the core is inside the tubes.
Okay.
On the outside of the tubes is clean water that's boiled to steam that goes to the turbine, that turns the turbine, that makes electricity. So all electricity except for hydro plants is generated by making steam, run it through a turbine, and you take, after that goes through the turbine, it's condensed. That's why you need a river, a lake, a cooling tower. It's condensed back into liquid water and pumped back so it can be reheated again. And you have some losses, and you have little systems that make up for it, but that's basically the cycle.
And the cooling towers are what typically in people's mind a nuclear plant looks like, right? Those big concrete structures, right?
Hyperbolic towers. Well,
okay.
Some of that's driven by local area issues for the environment, especially over the last few years. So they forced utilities to build towers, even though they might be sitting right next to a river or a lake. So you need that water to, the condenser is the device where the steam that goes through the turbine exhausts into that box, and it's a bunch of tubes that the cooling water runs through. So it could be river water, could be lake water, could be cooling tower water. It then turns the steam back into liquid so the pumps can pump it back to the steam generator, whatever's generating the steam, back to the boiler that's got the flame in it created by coal or gas, or back to the steam generators in a nuclear plant to be boiled again and make steam. And so it's a closed cycle either way.
So and the stuff coming out of that is vapor, not smoke, right? If you see anything coming out of a nuclear plant, it's not smoke. You mean it's not a smokestack.
Like a cooling tower?
Yeah.
It's a cloud. It's cold. It's highly moisturized air comes out the top of the cooling tower, and it hits cold air. It makes a cloud. It's not radioactive. It's not anything. It's not smoke.
There's like not that air on TV coming out. No, right.
It's not smoke.
Now, what's the difference between that and a coal or a gas plant then?
Well, nothing.
Nothing.
Except for the heat source. Gotcha. They have to cool the condenser the same way, turn the steam back into liquid, pump it back to where the flame is so it can heat it back up to steam. So they might have a cooling tower. They might use a river directly. They might use a lake, whatever.
Something else.
Works the same way. So the heat cycle was the same. It's just a matter of what generates the heat. Now, the big difference is there's no combustion process with the nuclear reactor. So that's a completely closed loop. So the water goes through the bottom of the core, comes out, gains about 60 degrees, go to the steam generators. There's multiple steam generators. Gives up some of that heat to the water on the outside of the tubes, which makes steam. Then it comes back to the bottom of the reactor, goes through there. So there's no combustion products going out of a nuclear power plant.
Gotcha.
Zero. Whereas a place that burns stuff, there's stuff going out the top of that 3 or 4 story building where the flame is.
It's constantly a
combustion process. Yeah.
Right.
You've seen the big stacks at coal and whatever plant burns stuff.
Right.
Well, the reason they're so high, again, that's environmental regulation. The higher you can put the stack, the more dispersion you get. So better for the environment, right? So,
right.
And you don't see any stacks. The cooling tower is not a stack.
Right.
There's no exhaust stacks coming out of a nuclear power plant.
Which I think is probably a misconception, right? Like, hey, there's just stuff pouring out of there, but it's just clouds.
Yeah.
Happy little clouds.
At TMI, when Walter Cronkite was on TV, they always had the cooling tower behind him.
Right.
And I know people sitting at home were saying, oh, look at that radioactivity. It wasn't radioactivity. It's just the cloud.
Right. You know, and that's and what year was TMI again?
It's 1979, March
79. So a few years after you got out, and we'll get there in a second, but there already are. So really there was directly, immediately more, there's pollution coming out of coal plants and anything else that burns, but not nuclear power plants.
No.
Right.
There is no combustion exhaust.
For everybody listening, big difference.
Yeah. No combustion exhaust out of a nuclear power plant.
Gotcha. Now the difference on waste, I guess, is between, let's say, use coal just because that's the majority, right? That's a big talk now of it comes out now, whereas for a nuclear power plant, you have to package the waste to make sure it's sealed up in different ways and then go store it somewhere.
The waste we're talking about is fuel that's been used in the reactor. Each refueling, which is about every 18 months, you change about a third of the core.
Gotcha.
So picture this. So you put the fuel that burns up the quickest is kind of toward the center of the core. So when you refuel, you take those fuel assemblies out of the center of the core, move the next set in, and you put new ones around the outside. So now you got fuel assemblies that can go radioactive again, fission, generate heat, so on. Gotcha. So after about 3 cycles, the entire core has been changed out.
Wow.
And then all you do is you take that fuel, there's a great big pool building with a pool in it, because there's so much radioactivity in that fuel assembly that the radioactivity, the radioactive field still heats the metal.
Gotcha.
In the, you know, the fuel assembly is about 13 feet tall. It's got about 200 and some fuel rods in it. And those fuel rods are filled with uranium pellets. So after it's been in that core, it's extremely radioactive. Radioactivity is energy, right?
Right.
So if you didn't have it in water, those tubes, again, even without being in the reactor and being critical, would heat up to an extreme temperature.
Gotcha.
So that's why you sit it in the pool. So the basic cycle is the waste we're talking about is spent fuel assemblies.
Right.
They go into a big swimming pool in racks. They sit there about 5 years.
Wow.
And then you can put them into what we call spent fuel storage casks. And there are metal ones and there are concrete ones. And basically the fuel by that time, the radioactivity has died off to the point where they can be cooled sufficiently by putting them in this cask of whatever makeup it is, metal or concrete or whatever, sit in open air in a pad and still get cold enough.
Gotcha.
Does that make sense?
So it doesn't get hot, yeah.
When you initially put them in, they're so hot, you have them for 5 years, so that radioactivity, eventually it dies off. I mean, it's not gone, but right. It gets down to a point where you can take it out of water, put it in a dry container, and it will still, if the container is designed properly, because the NRC has to approve them, the heat will come out of the container to the air.
And the water,
and you just sit them on a big concrete pad.
That's and water do. Cools it, and it just
no, there is no water cooling on a no. Once you put it in that, it's dry. You put them
sorry,
in there.
No, I mean when they're put in the pool in those racks initially. Water itself is able to cool the spent fuel and contain it because it doesn't leak out through the water.
Well, and it's a radioactive shield.
Right.
So there's about 40 feet of water over those fuel assemblies. So both the volume, it does get recirculated and it has heat exchangers, but it both cools it and it shields the radioactivity from coming out of the pool.
Wow.
So you can work around the edge of the pool.
No kidding.
That's the idea.
Yep. That's pretty amazing.
And the way they get it there, so when you take it out of the reactor, there's what they call a transfer tube. So you take a given fuel assembly, and it's all done underwater. You put it in this little fuel transfer device. So you do it vertically. You put it in the device, and you lay it down. It's like a little trolley. Then it goes through that tube over the spent fuel pool. Then they upright it, take the fuel out, put it in the rack, done.
Then it sits there.
That's how that works. Good. Yep. It's kept underwater all that time. Yeah.
Gotcha.
Yep.
So you mentioned the NRC, and we've talked about DOE. So that's Nuclear Regulatory Commission, right? And then there's the Department of Energy. What role do those two agencies play in is it commercial and public plants that they play a role in?
Generally speaking, the Department of Energy deals with legacy facilities that may have made, like Hanford, they were involved in making the initial atomic bomb, right?
Okay.
So to do that, you need to operate reactors to create certain fission products that go into a bomb. But the process of extracting those fission products is kind of chemically based. So you only extract certain isotopes, and all the other stuff you have to use to extract it, that's a lot of the waste that's out at Hanford. They threw it in tanks out there. So all that stuff that was used to extract the fission or the isotopes you needed is in tanks. And there's like 56 million gallons of it.
Oh, wow.
So that's the worry out there. That's why they're trying to get this project I'm working on going. The idea is to capture that stuff in glass so it can't get to the environment. So you capture it in glass, pour it into a stainless steel container, put a lid on the container, and go sit it on a pad somewhere.
So I guess what relationship does Department of, so when you say Department of Energy is responsible for legacy systems, just in general, the nuclear industry, are they an oversight body or are they?
Well, no, DOE is kind of its own regulator, if you will. And that causes some initial problems. They have some test reactors,
okay,
like the trigger reactor. And those reactors usually don't run at power. The old Hanford ones did to generate the isotopes you need. But they do it for experiments and that sort of stuff. So the reactor just pulses and then it shuts down. It doesn't sit there and generate electricity or anything like that. But a lot of the times, the DOE is its own regulator.
Gotcha.
And my experience with that is they don't quite operate the same as the commercial business with the NRC oversight.
And so you mentioned the NRC again. So what, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, are they then the body over commercial?
Yes. Okay. Well, they have jurisdiction over some other things like medical isotopes, where you have radioactive stuff to treat patients and stuff.
Gotcha.
They regulate that kind of stuff too. So basically, the NRC, when you go to build a nuclear power plant, you present the design to them.
Okay.
They have to approve the design because you're making the case that if I build this kind of reactor with these safety systems, it's safe to operate this thing. And they give you a license.
Okay.
First of all, they give you a construction permit based on, well, it looks like this is a viable design, so you can start moving dirt, but you're doing it at risk. There's no guarantee and they're going to give you an operating license.
So they don't approve the whole thing all at once.
Well, no, but gotcha. You got to think about it. That's a risk.
Yeah.
And when you start moving dirt, you're burning money real fast.
Right.
So you're hoping you can get all that design approved and get your tech specs so you can run the place. Right.
Right.
So that's a big deal. So you write what they call a safety analysis report that describes the reactor, what its power level is going to be, all the safety systems,
right?
Safety injection, containment, research spray system, blah, blah, blah. And the whole objective is to show that the reactor design and all the safety systems will adequately protect the environment and the public.
Okay.
That's the entire goal and genesis of a safety analysis report. So you go back and forth for years, present the design, they ask questions. Well, what about this? What about that? Well, and it goes on and on. So the worst thing you can do is not have the plant fully designed and then start moving dirt. And then find out down the road when you're burning about $2 million a day, you've got issues. You've got to go back to the NRC.
Right. Well,
that translates into, this is going to take a lot longer than we thought. And you're burning $2 million a day.
So that's a big difference in, it sounds like in the nuclear industry, say in IT and healthcare IT, just, generically, when we do projects or programs, right, for us, we can have a general idea, do kind of a basic charter and go, hey, what do you think? Here's what we're pretty sure we're going to do. It'll cost about this much. And then a little bit down the road, we'll do like a full kind of scope document where we get into the details. Right. But it sounds like you're not doing that in nuclear industry. Like you got to know upfront how it's going to work. What's that? There's no kind of agile iterative process going on with a nuclear plant.
No. Right? And so at the end of the process, you finally write what they call final FSAR, we call it final safety analysis report.
Okay.
Chapter 15, for example, of that report is all the transient analysis that says, if we have a steam line break, here's what happens. Here's why the core is still safe. Here's when safety injection activates. And you basically show that you can keep the core below a certain temperature limit, like 2000 degrees.
Gotcha.
At the surface of the tubes, fuel tubes, right? Fuel pins. So you go through that. I have a feedwater break. That's the line that sends water back to the steam generator to make steam, right? Well, if you lose that, now you're losing part of your heat removal capability. So okay. You got to show that's okay. Then if you have a, what they call a loss of coolant accident, that means you've analyzed for some pipe in the main coolant, in the main reactor system breaking. Now you got a hole in the main reactor system. And usually the safety analysis argument is the safety injection system can make up for the largest pipe break and still keep the core below a certain temperature.
So you have to have like contingency plans built in ahead of time also.
Like, well, yeah, but I mean, the basic safety systems have to perform, which didn't happen at TMI. They initially did, but then the operator shut them off.
Gotcha.
Okay. So you got to get water to that core.
Yeah.
You got to do that or you got a big problem like TMI. It's a big problem. So you're basically telling the story as to why the systems you've designed for the worst case event you can postulate, which NRC agrees is probably the worst case event, the core's still okay.
Gotcha.
That's, you know, basically
I mentioned that because for, again, the project management world, you kind of as needed, and some upfront, we did it way more. It's closer to me like when I would do public safety incident planning.
Yeah.
Right. Sure. We did contingency plan up front. There's a bomb, mass casualty, it's too hot, whatever.
Yeah.
Probably because of the nature of that business, probably similar to nuclear power of the nature of the business, right? You screw up and people die.
Sure.
And you know, in the plant versus say we're putting software in, and not that it can't have impact, especially in healthcare IT, but we don't always vet out a contingency plan way ahead of time. Before go live for sure. But that early, like in the process you're talking about, although honestly, I write that down because wouldn't it be great to game that out super early and say, hey, let's go through this. What if this fails while we're putting the software in?
Yeah,
what
are we gonna do? There you go. I would say, I'm guessing, but I would say the closest analogy to what we were just talking about is some of the software you do really doesn't endanger patients, but you had an operation that was done by a robot.
Yeah.
Right. So I imagine before the people approved using that machine, it had to go through a lot of same kind of thing. Think about it. So you're going to use this machine to work on people, right?
Right.
And you're going to run it with software. Now, I don't know does the FDA do that or who does that, do you think?
That certifies the robotic.
Like a machine like that. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm sure they're in there somewhere. I should ask at work. And for folks listening, I had kidney cancer removed in 2009 I had the robotic surgery, which was pretty amazing. The Da Vinci, so pretty awesome. Shout out Dr. Hampton to you. Thanks.
Yeah.
But
that's different than the software, your software you just installed at the children's facility that alerts you if a child's being moved.
Yeah.
Well, that's an important thing, but the child's not going to die because of it. Nothing's going to really happen to people. I mean, it's a good thing to know, but that robot, whole different deal. Yeah.
When it's has made an incision and it's inside a person.
Yeah.
A
little different.
You know, an infant intrusion, you know, where basically it's an alarm system for somebody trying to steal a child.
Oh,
It's tough, but when you're doing that, that's a great point. To try and capture, like I mentioned, kind of all your experience, and we kind of talked about some key points by the decades, and we were talking about the 70s and Three Mile Island, and touched on some of the things that went wrong there, but want to talk about some of the key things that you've been involved in your, you know, five decades of that. And in the 70s, one thing that we touched on was, and was a lesson learned, I think, from Three Mile Island, and just realized there's so many controls and you can't remember all of them. They're all over. They're maybe not in the best place because, hey, look, there's an open spot, put a knob there. And so you and a doctor looked at human factors, right? How do we make this thing?
Yeah.
So it's essentially kind of like we've touched on in IT, reverse engineering something, which isn't the optimal way to do it, but you all had to do that for the right reasons. Right. What was the, can you kind of summarize the process that you all did to enable human factors into a pretty technical layout of a nuclear plant.
Yeah. Well, one of the real serious problems was if you were going to do it, I'll just say properly, mm-hmm. you would design that board from the ground up that way. Right. So now here we're faced with a board that everybody's been trained on.
Right.
And right across the room, there are guys operating a reactor at 100% power, same board. And I'm over there going to mess with it. So if you were going to properly apply human factors, you would start from the get-go.
Right.
And put those kind of features in. But we had to retrofit and we couldn't fix everything.
Right.
I mean, it's just physically impossible. And think all the guys that are running the reactor across the room, because the control boards at North End and Surrey, they're all in one big room. There's no wall separating the control boards. The guys can see one another and they can hear one another and all that stuff. So the guys that were operating unit one were basically going to roll their chairs over there and operate the board that I just messed with. So there was some obvious retraining involved.
Right.
But the changes weren't that drastic, but it's the best we could do was enhance what was there.
Right.
We couldn't fix it all. For example, one of the best examples was a safety system, which is important to cooling the reactor, is what we call the auxiliary feed water system. So if the normal feed system that sends water to the steam generator, like I mentioned, to make steam, the auxiliary feed water system is used to get water to the generator to take energy out of the core. You're not worried about making steam anymore. You just need a heat sink because you can blow the steam from the generator to the environment.
Okay.
So you just need a heat sink. You need a way to suck the heat out of the core.
Gotcha.
And that's what auxiliary feed water is for. So on the control board, we're all, North End has three steam generators, AB, Alpha, Bravo, and Charlie. So they have a set of controls for each of those generators that you can use to run those pumps to make sure water gets to each of those generators, right? So the original layout of the board, there was part of the auxiliary feed water system here, and you go down the board a little ways, and there were switches for what we call a flash evaporator, which you could care if that thing fell out of the building. And then below that were some more auxiliary feed water switches. So right in the middle of the auxiliary feed water system were switches for a thing that just makes DI
relevant. Gotcha.
Yeah, it's irrelevant. So obviously what we did, and there are two electric pumps in the aux feed system and one steam driven one. So it's important to know if you got steam line pressure for the steam driven pump, right? Well, that meter was on the vertical board up by where the electrohydraulic control indicators were.
Not right in front of
you? Gotcha. No. So now, if you go to that board, a steam generator is here on the left. It's the steam-driven pump. That meter is right there. You can see and it goes A, B, C. The flash evaporator, we move completely out of the way up to the top of the board. So everything that's grouped there now is all auxiliary feed water. There's nothing in between them, and they're a Alpha, Bravo, Charlie. And the steam pressure meter is right on the bench board now, where the control for the steam driven pump is.
And imagine that. Some of those movements or labels you got there from it was a human behavioral specialist. Right.
Well,
and color coded things and
doctor.
Them.
Yeah. Dr. Silberman, they actually get trained in. They study human behavior, especially in stressful situations. Okay.
Gotcha.
So his experience in applying human factors that he had the expertise in was doing fighter cockpits.
Right.
Because that's a little stressful. Right. So you got to know where all the switches are. You got to be able to recognize the difference between them.
Yeah.
And you're in a kind of a stressful environment when you're trying to shoot somebody. So that was his expertise or his experience, not his expertise. He had never seen a nuclear power plant before.
Gotcha.
So I taught him in the process of doing this, how a nuclear power plant works. And he taught me how to, the extent we could, enhance things that were already there.
Gotcha.
We couldn't cut the board down to the base and start over.
Right.
So we thought of ways to, like auxiliary feed water, that definitely was a benefit.
Right. Right?
It's easier to understand where the switches are and they're all organized properly and so on and so forth. And then because the control went north end and sir, they have a bench section. Then there's about a 3-foot space. You can actually walk behind the bench and there's a vertical section.
Wow.
And the basic layout is most of the controls are on the bench, like for starting pumps and that sort of stuff. And the indicators for systems, pressure, temperature, flows are on the vertical board. So the way the board was built, there are a set of controls that are kind of grouped like for the primary coolant system that got the reactor coolant pump switches and a lot of other switches related to the primary system, the water that's involved with the reactor.
Gotcha.
And then on the vertical board, there's pressurizer level. That's the device that pressurizes the system to 2,235 pounds. There's other flow in the reactor coolant system. And so what we did in those cases is we shaded that area that encompassed all the switches related to the reactor coolant system and did the same thing on the vertical board. So right now, all switches that are associated with primary coolant are surrounded by gray. That gotcha. Whole area is like a gray. However, the story about, we need a space to put a switch.
Yeah.
When you go through that process, you find what Gene referred to as nested controls. In other words, it's a gadget in there, it doesn't belong there.
Gotcha.
So sure enough, in the reactor coolant system, there was, if you look at the board right now, there's highlighted switches that say this has nothing to do with the primary coolant system. They know what it does, but it stands out now. It's not like fairy because the board's all one color and you
it was tell. the key to that basically visual cues, visual color groupings and visual like labels that just make it obvious. These are for this and all these colors do the same thing.
Yeah. So we went around the board. So there's a section that has reactor coolant and then vertical section with indicators associated with that. Then you move to your right. It's the balance of plant stuff, the steam generator stuff, levels, pressures, steam flow, feed pump controls, same thing. So you highlight that
different
and there's a set of indicators on the vertical board associated with the steam part of the plant.
Gotcha.
So we did the same thing. So we were right. And what we didn't want to do, I've seen some recent pictures. I think they screwed it up. We put subtle colors in. So the thing didn't look like grandma's quilt, right? So we might have done a dark gray for primary coolant and a lighter gray or some shade of that for the balance of plant stuff. And we differentiated whether it was secondary plant stuff from primary, we put a black border around the primary stuff.
Okay.
So it not only had a slightly different color, it had a border around it. Whereas the steam plant, we didn't put a border. I saw some recent pictures of the North Atlantic control board. And I think the primary coolant system is bright blue or something now.
So big
to me, it doesn't look right. I'm sure it differentiates, but we didn't want to make it look like grandma's quilt.
Right.
We did that work. Yeah. Well, but the hardest thing we had to do, the NRC insisted on, I think I mentioned it to you yesterday, was install a lamp test feature, which meant you had to have a way, say once a shift, to verify all the lamps for indicators that indicated safety system performance, whether it was valve position or pump status or whatever, and turn those lights on and verify the bulbs are working. Well, there's hundreds of those things. And some of them are on the bench, some of them are on the vertical board, and they're not all segregated. There's other lights interspersed with the ones you're concerned with.
So those didn't necessarily equate to a value add.
Well, indicator. I mean, it's good to know whether the indicator is working. But what that meant to us was I had to go into every remember, we had tested the plant, verified all the control systems. I had to go in and touch every control system and figure out a way to light those lights and not invalidate the safety analysis report or make that safety function non-functional again. If somebody pushed a button, that I just defeat the safety injection system. Because if a pump were running, for example, in our nomenclature, when a pump's running, the red bulb's on. There's three bulbs, red, amber, green. Well, when that pump's running, I had to turn on the other two bulbs without tripping the breaker, causing a fault somewhere, defeating the functionality of the safety injection system, whatever. So imagine that task.
So I guess, does that equate to kind of a regulatory body or a someone just adding undue overhead?
Yes.
Gotcha. in summary.
But think about the timing. Okay. So here's Three Mile Island.
Right.
There's all these reports that say there's human factors issues with the board.
Nah.
You're not in a position to fight arm wrestle.
Right.
So think of the condition of North End of Two. At the time when Three Mile Island happened, we had already been through hot functional testing. That means what that test is, you heat the primary up, but use rack to coolant pump energy to take it up to temperature. The core isn't in yet. It's not working. But you can make steam, enough steam to actually run the main turbine for about 5 minutes. There's enough heat capacity there, right? Gotcha. So that's hot functional test. You're testing, getting the system up to temperature, actually making steam, spinning the turbine up, all that stuff.
Okay.
Okay. So once you're through that, the NRC agrees that your testing is adequate. You're ready to load fuel.
Oh.
So that's where we were. So I wasn't about to argue.
Right. Yeah.
And neither was management at Virginia Power. Said, George, for now, we'll just have to fix this.
We'll just get it.
Make it work. And guess what? This was the first. So I really wasn't too worried because it was the first time the NRC had seen an in-place upgraded control board.
Oh, wow.
So I figured if we did enough to impress them,
right,
it'd be fine.
Which is a great point.
Which is it was.
Between, you know, the way you just said it, yep. Other folks, you know, I follow Jocko Willink. Basically, sometimes you get orders, you get guidance, you get whatever that you know right off the bat, it's not going to be helpful. But you also know, team, we have to do this.
Yep.
So we're going to do it well.
Yeah.
And we're going to do it to the best of our ability.
Well, the other bad thing they did is on the board of what they call manual auto control stations. What they are it gives you a way, say you want to control a steam valve that releases steam to the environment. So that controller has got a little meter on it. Okay. And it's got push buttons. And so the operators learn that when the indicator, that little meter goes up, that means the valve is opening. So if that valve is opening, they know what the valve is. It's releasing steam to the atmosphere, which should bring the pressure in the steam generator down, right? So the NRC insisted that that meter had to mirror what the end product was supposed to be. In other words, they wanted the meter to go down to indicate you're lowering steam pressure. Now, if that didn't screw up the operators' minds, fortunately, we had enough near misses. That one I did try to argue about.
Yeah.
Say they know what this valve is doing. They know right. What the end result's going to be. You shouldn't. And well, that was another one we lost for a while, but then we came back and had a few near misses and kind of told them we really because need to put that. These back. Yeah, we need to put these back where they were. And they didn't argue with us.
Right.
So that one, again, you had to bite the bullet and say, okay, yeah. I hope we don't do anything too bad. But this is really going to mess with the mind of the operators because they knew exactly. They've been trained for hours and hours and hours, knew the plant backwards and forwards and what that valve was doing.
Yeah.
And they knew what the signal meant. The signal going up meant the signal going to the valve was making the valve go up.
Right.
which it resulted in the steam pressure going down because they were dumping steam to the atmosphere. Yeah.
I mean, I was going to say another good example of you do it and how you and your team decided, you know what, this is the time we have to give that feedback up the chain of command.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
And not to be worried about doing it because it's not just helping you all, like it's going to help them. And they realize like, hey, this is actually screwing things up.
Yeah. It's making it less think safe. About again, if you keep in sight the overall goal,
yeah,
it's reactor safety, right?
Yeah.
All of us, NRC, operating crew, everybody that owns that nuclear power plant, our mission is reactor safety. Yeah, we generate electricity, but that's our goal and focus.
Regardless of what logo's on your shirt. It's the same thing. Yeah. I mean, that's similar, you know, I've run into, which is good. And it's hard to do whether you're a team member or a team leader or whatever, is tell the executive or the governing body that gave you this guidance. And imagine then after Three Mile Island, right? And the media's going crazy and they want overcorrection and this and that. But but even in projects, to say, you know what, boss, sponsor, business owner, whomever, we talked about it, we can probably do it, but here's how much more it's going to cost in time or money or mistakes to that point, or it's going to actually not increase the safety. It sounds like decrease the safety, right? Which
that's right.
You know, I think it's easier for folks after, because it happens now, right? Now it's shootings, before it was planes in buildings and it was hurricanes. Like it's an overcorrection by all the stuff, do all these things.
I always read, you know, there's always good write-ups and summaries on catastrophic events, like the Challenger. I don't know if you remember the Challenger.
Yep.
It blew up, right?
Yeah, I was watching that.
So here's this meeting, and it's an unusual day in Florida, but it's cold. And the engineers are telling the people that want to launch this thing, the O-rings are too cold. Mm. You should not fire up this rocket. The O-rings are too hard. They won't seal like they ought to seal. And guess what? They got overridden by the groupthink, and we got to make this schedule.
Right.
They killed a bunch of people.
Right.
Bottom line.
Right.
So the problem you run into in those situations is afterward, the senior folks come and say, well, why weren't you more adamant about that? Well, think about the psychology.
Yeah.
The guy or woman's only going to be so adamant, they still got to keep their job.
Right.
Right. Unless they're willing to say, I'm out of here.
Right.
You guys are making it. Very few people do that. I'm sorry to say. Because they were just, based on their knowledge, saying this is not a good idea. They couldn't say it will absolutely blow up the rocket.
Right.
They couldn't say that.
Right.
So the groupthink started and boom, off it went.
So that's a great point too. Is as much as you should say it, again, when you're thinking this job pays for my house and feeds my family.
That's it. You think of psychology of groups like that are responsible for things that could affect the safety of other people.
Right.
It's not a good situation sometimes.
No. So let's go. We're still in the 70s. We're talking about great stuff. Let's just touch on in the 80s. So we start to get into both everybody, and then in particular the nuclear, this some data driven stuff, right? Computing's coming up more and
getting
a little more modern. And we touched on some, you know, some systems that you have, particularly with, there was a disaster at Surrey, disaster, I guess there was an accident, right? Disaster to folks that died for sure. And folks affected. But a positive, I guess, if you will, out of that is you and some other folks had put in the time to get systems in place where you could read what was happening, not just during that, but before and after it, to be able to troubleshoot. And so can you kind of touch on the value of that ability to drive data? And particularly, you mentioned like this is real data, not simulation data.
All right. Well, the thing, let me help with perspective a little bit. So you have a operating crew at the plant, right? You have an engineering staff. And then for off normal events, you have a corporate emergency response team, right? And also, NRC has a corporate emergency response team.
Right.
So if there's an event at the plant, we man our corporate emergency response. They man theirs. And the system that we put together because of TMI sent data to the NRC too, so they could see real-time plant conditions. Okay. So the value was we could sit at the Innsbruck Emergency Response Center.
Right.
A part of what came out of TMI was there were too many cooks in the kitchen. Mm. The crew's trying to save the reactor, and there's people telling them this and telling them that, and more experts show up, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
So part of the concept that came out of the write-ups about that accident was, we need a better way to be able to see what's going on at the plant, but not drive the operating crew crazy.
That's great. Yeah.
Interfere with what they're trying to do. They're right. Busy enough without folks poking their nose in there that think they know what they're doing.
Right.
So we could literally sit at in the Innsbruck Technical Emergency Center. And I was the advisor at that time to the VP of Nuclear Operations, Mr. Stewart. And I had all the technical guys under me, engineering, health physics, all those sort of folks. So we could sit there, and because of the system we put together, we could tell what was going on in the plant. We could see what was happening. We could see if they were cooling the reactor down okay and all that sort of stuff. And we didn't have to bug the control room.
Right.
The only reason we would bug the control room was if we thought we saw something abnormal. An example of that at Surrey, not so much. We got the report about the fire suppression systems and all that, but that's not monitored on the computer. That's just something that happened in the plant.
Gotcha.
But at North Anna, when we had the tube rupture in July of 87, again, they had to cool the reactor down. And the system you use to cool it down is what they call the residual heat removal system. It's just a little cooling loop, if you will, with heat exchangers that pump water through the reactor. The heat exchangers are cooled by component cooling water. So you're sucking heat out of the reactor with a different source of water.
Gotcha.
Basically, but to put that system in service, there's one suction line with two series valves in it. And then the discharge of the system is two lines going to two different loops. So if you can picture, the North Anna reactors have three loops. So two of the discharge lines go to, say, Alpha and Bravo loop. The suction line, say, comes from Charlie loop. And that suction line has two series valves in it. Well, by procedure, to put that system in service, you're supposed to cycle one at a time those suction valves to make sure they're working before you open them both, because you might need to close them, right? If something's wrong when you pressurize the system.
Okay.
And so we were watching, and we saw one of the valves cycle. They're 1700 01 and 02, I think it's the valve numbers. Anyway, they cycled one, and all of a sudden we saw flow in the RHR system. We never saw the other valve cycle. Hmm. So Mr. Stewart gets on the phone. He's got the procedure right in front of him, right?
Yeah.
Hey, we didn't see you guys, because the NRC is watching all this, right? We didn't see you guys cycle that valve. Oh, we should have told you guys that valve has a broken limit switch. It's been that way for a while. We need to fix it. Hmm. Well, first of all, Mr. Stewart wasn't real happy about that, but he said, okay, I got you. Just as long as we follow procedure.
Yeah,
that's good. Well, in the other situation in that particular event, that's the one that had the steam generator tube rupture. That means one of the tubes in the steam generator broke in half. So now you're shooting reactor water into the steam generator that's supposed to have clean water in it. So that radioactive water, you got a hole in the primary system, basically.
Yeah.
It's going in the steam generator. So the remedy to that for the time was you depressurize the reactor coolant system, try and equalize it with the steam generator, which is around 800 pounds, and it kind of slows down putting reactor coolant into that vessel. right? Then you bottle up the faulted steam generator. I mean, you just close it off, valve it off. Now all that radioactive water from the primary system is isolated, captured. Yeah, it's radioactive, but it's captured in that vessel, right?
Okay.
And here's where the regulation and organizations and what I call shade tree lawyer thinking comes in.
Gotcha, so, yeah.
So the criteria for declaring you're in cold shutdown, and the reason you need to understand the reason for these things is you cool the reactor plant down to the point where it can't make steam so that you can open the containment building. So you got rules that say, hey, if the reactor cooling system is above this temperature, you can't open the containment because it might break and that stuff go out to the environment.
Not good, yeah.
So cold shutdown has a defined set of temperatures and pressures and all that stuff and have an RHR in service. So, however, comma, we got down to that point on the other two loops that were operating, right? Well, the faulted steam generator couldn't cool down. It wasn't getting feed water. There was no steam being released. So there we sat. Two loops were at conditions for declaring you were a cold shutdown. But there sat a steam generator at 400 pounds pressure with the radioactive fluid in.
Ew.
So are you really in cold shutdown?
So being meaning you met specifications that didn't necessarily.
Well, if you wanted to play shade tree lawyer,
yeah,
you could say, well, the other two loops are meet tech specs. But the basis for being in cold shutdown is you don't have a source of steam that can release radioactive material, right?
Well, there's a big old source.
What do you got? You got a great big old steam generator sitting at 400 pounds pressure.
Right.
Yeah, it's bottled up. And Bill was going to declare we were in cold shutdown, and I went over and whispered in his ear. I said, Bill, here's what I think we ought to do. So I got the HP techs and guys that, because they could take a grab sample of the what was in the concentration of radioactivity in the generator.
Mm-hmm.
I said, guys, I want to calc. Now, the limit of radiation at the site boundary by license was 100 millirem per hour. Okay.
Gotcha.
That's a site boundary dose limit. So I said, I want you to assume we blow away all the inventory in that generator. Tell me what the site boundary dose is. They did that calc. They came back and says, I think we're okay, George. It's like 50 MR. I said, no. Then I went back over to Mr. Stewart and said, okay. It was not the time to play shade tree lawyer. Because if you understood the basis for what cold shutdown meant, you really were not in cold shutdown.
So you want to know based on ground truth, not what the checklist says, like what's really happening there. You know what I mean?
Well, that's why for tech specs, one of the things I had installed in technical specifications when they reworked them, because the guy that was on that committee, I was on the reactor trip committee. I encouraged him to offer to be chairman of the tech spec improvement subgroup for obvious reasons, because I had a lot to say.
Yeah.
But so we needed to improve tech specs. And the thing I directed him to do, I said, look, we don't want any more tech specs without the basis explained. We got to quit treating operators like mushrooms, keep them in the dark and feed them BS, right?
Yeah.
If they better understand why we even have that tech spec, they'll more effectively implement it. So now there's a section of the tech specs that didn't used to exist, and it's the basis. Why? What does safety injection have to do? How does it have to do it? Why do we have it? And then it's for every other thing in there. So the basis section of the tech specs now is as thick as, probably thicker than the tech specs.
It explains every
spec. And why you have to meet it, what the design basis is, why it's important to keep it in service, blah, blah, blah.
That's a huge, I mean, which, you know, and just having good teams that trust you and, you know, one, they know you call their leader's intent, right? What's the task, purpose, and end state of all this stuff. And then,
right,
as you know, the why, right? If people know the why,
yeah,
we can figure out the how. And that's a huge, that's, you know, like step one and good change management is
Oh, yeah.
Folks know why we're doing this. right? Yeah. And do they know you support it and all that good stuff?
You know, if I experience this, if I know the why, then the what sticks in my brain better.
Yeah.
Because I understand the basis. Oh, yeah.
Right.
I get it. But if you just tell me, do this because I said so,
right?
That doesn't work. Doesn't work for me. People don't want to be treated like they're stupid.
No. I mean, especially in that field, to your point, where they're not, right? Like, that's not
well, really we did that for years, the operator. So part of that task also, I said, look, because we work with Westinghouse, you know, these are Westinghouse textbooks and stuff. I said, look, I want you guys to go out. You're committed to go out and talk to at least 10 operating crews from around the country and have them tell you what kind of issues they have with textbooks. Because they got to run the plant by these things.
Yeah.
So if they're ambiguous, it makes their life miserable. Because when they're operating, they got to make judgments on whether they need to shut the plant down or not. And so if a tech spec's fuzzy, the decision is fuzzy.
Right.
Right. What should I do? My interpretation of this is X.
Right.
When in fact, it really means Y. We shouldn't have any of those. Not when you're operating a nuclear reactor. You can't do that.
So is that when you get into, so you're, you know, using data driven at Virginia Power, but then you also got into operational performance and safety. Was that part of that initiative where you were trying to really help improve not just where you were, but synergy in the nuclear industry, really, right? Across the country to go, hey, we're all on the same team. We're all working toward the same stuff. Yep. And then, you know, going to share, and I know you can elaborate on this, of helping to get where using data and better specs and stuff like that went from, you know, again, you would have trips, you'd be up, what, 65% of the time, and then it was you're up 93% of the time, so a huge increase in not
taking. And reactor trips are a rarity now all across the country. They very seldom have a reactor trip. They go 18 months, put new fuel in, do it again.
So did you see, when you sent those folks out, did they come back with some obvious patterns?
Oh, yeah. So all this started in 85. 85, just as a refresher, TMI happened in March of 79. So we're 6 years down the road.
Gotcha.
And we're having that kind of reactor performance.
Wow.
1.5 reactor trips a day, 65% capacity factors. And you're going, we're gonna revisit control room designs, operator training. And the other problem with it is, I guess the best analogy I can explain is, if you had a Mercedes Benz and you were doing testing and you had this road, straight road, and it was wet, run it down that road 100 times at 100 miles an hour and slam on the brakes. And every time it should stay in a straight line, right? Well, that's the theory.
Right.
Well, 20% of the time, reactors didn't stay in a straight line. Something went wrong. A pump didn't start. A valve didn't open or close like it was supposed to. So now you got the NRC and the dig in. Well, why'd that happen? That's not supposed to. Did you not do right maintenance? Are you guys not maintaining the plant? Do you not know how to keep this thing going? Right. See, that's where the corrective action system comes in. So an example, we got dinged on the north end of tube rupture because, so we're getting the reactor cooled down. The steam generator is all bottled up. We got all that issue solved. But outside the control room on a platform by the condenser, there was a radiation monitor that was supposed to monitor an exhaust pipe that comes from the condenser to let you know if you have a tube rupture, because that it's called a air ejector. So the air ejector sucks on the condenser because you run the condenser at sub-atmosphere pressure. In other words, it's in a vacuum, right? And if that sensing device, the radiation detector, saw radioactivity, which is supposed to be an indicator you got a tube rupture, right? Radioactivity shouldn't be in that flow path. It's supposed to redirect the exhaust from that eductor from atmosphere to the containment to make sure none of that goes. It probably wouldn't hurt anybody, but that was a design.
Okay.
It goes from exhausting that steam to atmosphere to redirecting it into the containment building. So one of the RC guys is walking up the pathway to the control room. He sees an auxiliary operator come out of the control room, go over to that rad monitor and pull the fuses. Well, they knew that if they pulled the fuses and killed that monitor, it would swap over the valve from atmosphere to the containment. And why did they have to pull the fuses? Well, you go in the corrective action system and it says, you know, this darn sensing line keeps filling up with condensate because it's coming off a line with steam in it. And so the rad monitor is blind. It was in the corrective action system for 2 years. So now we had a super performance in the control room with a design basis tube rupture. The operating crew did phenomenal. They had the thing bottled up in 30 minutes. The reactor was cooling down. And what did we get gigged on? Something we should have fixed. 2 years old. The NRC watched it happen.
Oh, gotcha.
So that's one of those things. Says, well, this isn't important. It's just a rad monitor, and it just detects the first radioactivity in that pipe and makes sure it gets redirected into the containment building. Well, somebody, the culture development says, well, that's not really important, is it? It's just a little radioactivity. That's not the point.
Right.
It's designed to automatically redirect that stuff in a containment building, and you guys let it go for 2 years.
And then you got busted.
Not acceptable.
Right.
Not acceptable. So anyway, so 85, 6 years after TMI, we're having all these problems. So I actually volunteered. We were in a meeting in Atlanta, and we're sitting around the table, and there's all these utility representatives. I was one. I was a director at the time at Virginia Power. Had responsibility for both Surrey and North Anna and the independent safety engineering group. And people were arguing about whether we needed to fix the problem.
Wow.
When I came in that room, knowing what I knew, I said, I don't even understand why we're arguing about this. We need to fix the problem.
Right.
This is unacceptable performance. It's unsafe. It's financially stupid. Call it what you want.
A lot of different
reasons. So I said, I'll tell you what, I'll volunteer to be the chairman of an effort, a group working with Westinghouse to fix this. That's nice. How I became the chairman. So 4 years later, and what we started to do, I think I mentioned yesterday, Westinghouse, fortunately at the time, even though all the plants were built running, they had site representatives and they had a rather crude computer-based reporting system. So the guys every morning could kind of give plant status and send it into Pittsburgh. It was kind of a way for them to commute back and forth. And it was computer-based, so it was pretty easy. So then IMPO, an organization was formed after Three Mile Island. Again, it comes back to the human performance aspect of things. They developed this human performance evaluation system. What it was is a bunch of forms asking certain questions to get a sense of how people do things, what they're thinking at the time.
Like behavioral questions?
Yeah, that sort of stuff. Gotcha. So we converted that form into a reactor trip report.
Wow.
And we got it to every Westinghouse rep at every power plant. Said, nice. If they have a reactor trip, you can't skip anything. You got to fill this form out. I don't care how painful you think it is. How many reactor coolant pumps were running? Did they trip it manually or did it trip by itself? What were the plant conditions at the time? Did all the equipment work properly? Blah, blah, blah. So we just started to accumulate these things.
Oh, gotcha.
And say, okay, what are we seeing here? We're having all these trips. What's the culprits, right? The other thing we did is every time you had a plant event like that, a reactor trip, you had to send a licensee event report to NRC.
Oh, wow.
And explain why you think the reactor trip, what you had to fix, blah, 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 so you could go back online. So we reviewed about like 500 of those things.
And was that old school, like paper copy reviews?
Yep. Yeah. We're talking. Dang. Yeah.
That's
so no joke. We're reviewing these things. And all of us are reviewing them, knew a bit about plant ops and maintenance and stuff. So we're sitting in a meeting one day and we said, we reviewed 500 of these and 33% of them are fairy tales.
Wow.
So folks made up something. They pencil thought, up in it. Yeah, I think I know the problem. Here's what we're doing about it. We need to get this sucker. It doesn't say that in the form, but we need to get this sucker back online.
Yeah.
So 33% of those were kind of bogus information because we were operations driven. We got to get this sucker running again. We didn't really care if we understood why we got in that condition in the first place.
Was that operations meaning financially? You're losing money.
We got to generate, man. We got to generate. You're losing $500,000 or $750,000 a day. Okay. Wow. So there, right there is a cultural problem, right?
Yeah.
We know it's important to generate. Yeah. But you can't, the thing that you didn't find out was the root cause of why that happened. So guess what? It's lurking in the weeds again to bite you in the butt again.
Right.
It's great you wrote that great LER report to get back online, but there's a little gremlin in that still station waiting to get you.
Dang.
Because it's always been my way of explaining it. The plant does not care if you're the CEO, the person that sweeps the turbine deck, the operator in the control room. If you don't do the right things and keep it healthy, it don't care. It will tell on you.
Right.
It doesn't care who you are. It doesn't care if you're the board of directors.
Right.
It doesn't care. It's a dumb machine. If you leave gremlins in there, the machine's going to let you know sooner or later.
So the outcome of all that data gathering was you saw trends and then you could say, look, here's some improvements you can make, whether it's systems, equipment, workflows, whatever, and then you training, already able to standardize that out to the to all those.
So what we ended up doing is saying, okay, and there's two kind of different operating points you're interested in. One is startup. Startup is difficult because the plants and the instrumentation are designed to be at 100% power. So when you're at low power, the feed water flow is on the bottom of the scale, the steam generator levels are about normal, but a lot of the instrumentation is at the bottom of the scale.
Okay.
You're not getting, it's hard to tell really what's going on. I mean, you know what you're operating and where you're trying to get to, but so an example of that is we had a group go around, or we had a group come to the Westinghouse simulator, and they seem to be the operators that always got called in to start up the plant. And so we wanted to know why that was. What was their model for getting through that process, given the indication in the greatest for getting there? And a lot of the trips at that level were caused by main feed water. Okay. It was like 38% of the time it was main feed water.
Yeah.
So basically they shared with us kind of in essence, a trick they learned. So the reactor doesn't care power-wise where the steam's going. Okay. So you have a set of valves in the plant that's called, some of them call them turbine bypass valves, the other one call them steam dump valves. They basically are connected to the main steam lines, and you can direct steam right into the condenser without going through the turbine.
Right.
So, and most of those valves are good for somewhere around 40% power. If I were to open all those up, I could run the reactor at 40% power and keep it balanced, keep it in equilibrium.
Gotcha.
Reactor doesn't care. It's saying, hey, steam's going somewhere.
Sending it somewhere, yeah.
I need this much power, right?
Gotcha.
So their trick was a big deal. And you're also, if you take it up to that power, now things are coming in range, right? The indicators, the flow indicators, and so forth, steam flow, feed flow. So the trick was get the steam ducts to where the reactor's up to 30 or so percent power, 35. Start bringing the main turbine on. And as you bring the main turbine on, it's coming up. back off the steam dumps. So you just swapped where the steam was going. So instead of going straight in the condenser, now it's going through the turbine. But the reactor doesn't know the difference. It's just, it's steam flow. Right. It doesn't care. So much heat's coming out of the system, I don't care. So then if you do that, when you have the steam dumps, you put main feed water on automatic level control, okay? Because at the bottom, a lot of it was, we can't control the steam generators. We got a low level or a high level and the reactor trips off. Well, now you put main feed in automatic. Now it's automatically control level instead of the operators guessing. And off you go. You're good to go. However, comma, if you're going to try that trick, please make sure that your steam dump valves work properly. So it's a great idea, but these valves need to work properly or you're going to get yourself in trouble.
So as someone that certainly doesn't know at all how the plant works and kind of understood what you just said, you all saw a trend, right?
Yeah.
And said, this thing keeps happening 30 some percent of the time that causes us to trip. And then what was it that you gave? Was it a change in the procedure that then could help reduce that?
Well, it was kind of a change in how you did startup.
Okay,
and this,
gotcha.
It was credible because this was coming from folks that did this all the time. It wasn't coming from a bunch of engineers in the ivory tower.
Wasn't theory.
One coming from management. So this is coming from guys that do this all the time. They're called in the middle of the night to get the dang plant online because they know how to do it better than anybody else.
Right.
So we produce a report and operators would go, yeah, that sounds like a good idea.
We
ought to incorporate that in our,
And it was from people like them, right? The data was from was from their peers. It wasn't from a theorized study in books, right? No. That's huge.
It was real world.
Right. I mean, it's similar to not to dog them, but the Project Management, Institute and the body of knowledge, basically the giant book that is the basis for your PMP certification.
Right.
Right. It's got some practical stuff in there.
Right.
And it's got a lot of stuff that nobody uses. Right.
Yeah.
I've rarely seen. The benefit of it is, say you're going to start a project management office or you're new in project management, the theories and and some of the tools, it's good to say, hey, we're going to base our structure off these kind of things.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then you get to the real world and realize here's about the 30% of that you actually need.
Yeah.
From people about in the field, right?
The real bottom line to that is that you don't think you don't know as much as you think you know.
Yeah.
Don't be afraid to ask other people.
Yeah. Great point.
Don't be afraid to ask. Don't let your ego get in the way of real knowledge.
Great point.
So that's what we implemented, the whole thing. Most of the reports we put out were not coming from an ivory tower. For example, another one, it was less percentage, but the electrohydraulic control system is just a big cabinet with electronics in it, controls 3,000 pound hydraulic fluid that operates the big valves that control the turbine, either shut it off completely or control the speed up.
Right? Gotcha.
So they were sending, they were having issues maybe in the cabinet, and they would send a technician in there with inadequate training and an out-of-date tech manual.
Oh, no.
Well, you may as well play Russian roulette and put 6 bullets in the gun because it's one of those gremlins that's going to get you. The plant doesn't care.
Right.
If you go do stupid things, it could be the CEO going in there and it's going to bite you anyway. It doesn't care.
Sounds like another leadership kind of correction too.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's been the hardest thing in my experience in all these years, Kev, is the people side of things. And getting people out of the group think mode.
Right.
Just look, we know you're important. Well, you know you're a smart person, but guess what? There's other smart people out there too.
Yeah.
And they got stuff you might need to know.
Good point.
So do not run a meeting and discourage them from talking.
Right.
That's the key.
Yeah.
Put your damn ego. Well, I had this problem up at the WTP project. because it's been going on so long, they get in a rut, right? So the loud, usually what happens initially till I started fussing at them was the loudest guy in the room always won.
Yeah.
Because he intimidated his peers and the DOE people. So he or she always won because they were the loudest and they talked the most.
Right.
So they didn't get the information they needed. That's fine. You can run a meeting that way, but doesn't work out well usually.
No. And so, yeah, eventually those folks hopefully get rooted out anyway. And it's like,
In 4 years, to sum it up, in 4 years, we turned the entire industry around because eventually we were doing so well and figuring this stuff out. We were initially just the Westinghouse units, the Babcock and Wilcox, combustion engineering, and GE joined us.
Wow.
So now we had the whole fleet in the United States. At the time, I think the Westinghouse units were maybe half or a little over half the units.
Okay.
But eventually we got them all, drew them all in, shared the information like we should have been doing anyway.
Right.
And all the lessons learned went to all the plants in the country.
That's huge.
So that made a big, difference. So what did we change in all this? Attitudes. Mm. We didn't, there wasn't 10,000 design changes involved. We didn't change out. Everybody had ASCO solenoid valves, Willamette pumps, limit torque operators, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
It's all the same dang hardware.
Yeah.
What's the difference? So what's the performance difference? It's the people.
Yeah.
It's the people. Everybody says, oh, we designed this safety system to shut down the reactor and trip turbine, blah, 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 open the trip breakers and so on. So in the case of the Surrey North Anna events, that system was done in less than a minute.
Mm.
Yeah, tripped the reactor, shut down the turbine, did what it was supposed to do, and guess what? It couldn't deal with the fire suppression system going off that weren't supposed to go off.
Right.
Couldn't deal with the pipe rupture in the people that were hurt in the turbine building.
Right.
So what's the difference? A synchronized, dedicated group of people that feel like they own the place. This is my power plant. Don't you mess with it.
Right.
Tell me what you think the problem is, because I might have a different opinion because I run the dang thing.
Yeah.
But don't be afraid to share that.
It's a great point, yeah.
It makes a difference. So the organization needs to put a pin in its ego. When you have a meeting, do it for the purpose of learning things, not showing how smart you are.
Yeah.
Big difference, right?
It is.
Big difference to the environment in the room, who participates, whether they're scared to participate or not. That used to always worry me. I would do my darndest when we had a meeting to draw in people that I knew were naturally shy.
Right.
We were good if we were just clowning around in my group and doing stuff. But you got them in a room with a bunch of execs and me, and they just clammed up. And,
right.
And you've run into that. They just, so you got, it's up to the leader to create an environment that alleviates that. Now, they're always still going to be shy.
Sure.
They got stuff up here you need to know.
Right.
They just do.
Right.
They're doing different stuff than you. If you're trying to figure out, well, how do we make the office more efficient? I'm sure they may not know how the reactor works, but they can sure help you make the office more efficient. Because here's what I do every day, and I think this stuff we're doing here is dumb.
Yeah.
We shouldn't be doing that. Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I'm glad you told me.
Right. That so feedback. Feedback's good.
I'm afraid still to this day, the intimidation factor in leadership is still too prevalent.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how, if you've run across it still, but the loudest person in the room isn't always right.
Right.
The one that always talks the most isn't always right.
Right.
And they need to learn that. If they don't learn that, they're not going to have an effective organization. Just not going to happen.
Yep. Yeah.
Human nature. Right.
I've definitely seen it. I'm lucky nowadays, honestly, that the leaders kind of talk the least, which is great. and are open to a lot of stuff. We talked about it, and something, you know, similarly, I try and model honestly is, other than getting the meeting started and facilitating it.
Right.
Really the team builds the plan, and I make sure to support them to make it happen.
Yeah.
Right. That's really my job, not to do that all for them.
It's a 100%. Team to get something done. Right.
Yep.
Absolutely. And you gotta use it, especially the complex stuff you do.
Yeah.
Everybody's gotta make it work, because this doing that network stuff and all the stuff you guys do is not easy.
Yeah. And you know, so I'm talking about before of you know, the difference of it, instead of it's my plant, like, hey, these are my patients, this is my hospital, this That's is it. Right, which is not the guy in the network closet or gal.
Yeah.
You know, has a different perspective than the person that's putting the bandages right. on, that's doing this, and oh, yeah. all of it goes together to mesh, similar to your point, sweeping the floor, doing the controls, writing the executive policies, whatever, it all has to go together and yeah. has to be treated, you know, different, but equally, right? They affect things
yeah. Oh, yeah.
in different ways. But
yeah. Well, this may sound sappy, but another way I would express it is, hey, we're taking care of children.
Yeah, 100%.
We got to get this done.
That was, yeah, pretty proud.
And we got to make it work right.
Yeah, absolutely. The so that's a huge difference. So many, I think, lessons that people can apply, whether they're in nuclear power or not, to what you just talked about, of changing culture and people. Yep. And just to touch on, just because we're a bit over an hour, I think I'm going to do a part one and part two, honestly, which is great. But to that, so in the 2000s, it seems like largely between, you know, the 2000s and now, you know, 2020s, it's a lot moving toward digital, planning for digital controls, yep. those kind of things,
yep.
And updated and improvised tech specs.
Well, we call them, they're improved from the old stuff. They're not
improved. Improvised. Gotcha.
Yeah, they're improved.
Yeah. So for, you know, to do that, is it really, you know, especially a bit in the 90s, but really in 2000s, you know, that digital world, you know, everything going yep. digital displays, which is amazing for me, you know, and I'm sure you just, and you were a pioneer in early computing with Macs and things like that. And, but it's just amazing the transformation that technology's had yep. in not that long of a period of time to what they yep. have now. Yep. So is there, are the obstacles, and actually I think you touched on it too, of you know, what are a couple big advantages of digital, and what are some cautions, like you mentioned keeping your analog while you add the digital, right. but what are some cautions you would have with,
well, I mean, if it works properly, as you know about digital stuff, you can go into, like, say there's a safety system logic, and you can go in there and look to see if that logic is functioning properly. For example, the system I was helping license that is made in Germany, TXS, you can actually get on a machine and look into the bowels of that thing. For some reason, we're getting an alarm from the, say, safety injection system. You can go in there and look to see where the logic's faulty. Well, you can't do that with an analog system. You can't,
more precise. Can't
Yeah.
troubleshooting
and I'm here to tell you, the NRC is very nervous about total, they still are, computer digital. Control
is that like from just, kind of infrastructure protection standpoint and hacking, and you know, I mean, well, there's some legitimacy there, it seems
a bit, but again, it's the whole focus is reactor safety, right? What if this thing doesn't do the functions that you say are supposed to work in the safety analysis?
Mm. Right,
because you can't test it the same way, right?
Yeah,
analog memory. Thing, you can take a meter down there, see if the transmitter is sending you what you need, then you can go to the end of that wire and see that you got 10 volts and blah, yeah. blah, blah. If some code in there is doing something squirrely, you might find out the hard way.
Harder to find, yeah.
Right, so a big deal in digital is the quality assurance aspect of managing that software, just like the robot we talked about, right?
Right.
How did you assure that the code you wrote will do under varying conditions now? For right. example, if you're running the plant, I think I mentioned it yesterday, and you lose offsite power, what does the plant do? How does it behave? And then it comes back. Sometimes that causes more problems than when it goes away.
Yeah.
Because things start back up, they re-energize. So what happens to the computer system? Is it, have you got all of it on a UPS uninterruptible power system, and so it just stays on? Or are there parts you forgot, and this little switch over here shuts down, and all of a sudden you lose communication somewhere? So you got to go through that thing with a fine-tooth comb. How do you manage the quality assurance of the software? And architecturally, how have you set this thing up? Are there any single point failures in this thing that could bring the whole world crashing down around your ears? And you got a nuclear reactor to take care of. That's why I'm kind of inclined to say, okay, the systems I put in are just for display, which works great. Now you're going to be able to go on a screen and say, I want to start the main feed water pump. You hit touch screen, boom, pump starts, right? And that's, I think it's great. I've been trying to push utilities in that direction.
Yeah.
But to, I'm kind of like the NRC, I guess, now. To go full bore and not have a backup, it's there anyway, because I can implement the digital
on top of it.
I hardly have to do anything except set up workstation.
Right.
Just like now, we got digital displays in several locations in the control room. It's just you can't control stuff with it, but you can monitor every system in the plant. Well, now I touch a button on a screen and get some action in the plant.
Right.
But what if it doesn't happen?
Then you got to have a failover to the analog system or
something. Or you just leave the normal controls there that everybody's trained on, knows how to operate. And somehow be able to do the control of that pump in parallel.
Right.
But not have it interfere with one another. In other words, if I'm doing digital control, I could still go over there to the analog switch and change state. No matter what the digital control said to do.
Right.
Unless you need to lock something out because you don't want that to happen. But you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
The guys already know the board. It's already there. It's been in there for years. You know it works. Okay, so I would start up by putting digital control stations. That's easy to, doesn't take up a lot of space and a lot of cabinets, right? And try and operate that way and see what kind of things you run into. And I know it's tested in a simulator and all that kind of stuff, and the software is tested. But like I say, in certain conditions, like if power's flopping around, how does that system behave?
Right.
What's the architecture look like? What's the power supplies look like? Does something lose power that is critical to getting information somewhere else? The only one way to find out.
It's a good case for a phased approach then, right? Like,
oh yeah.
Hey, let's add this component, run it a little bit. Let's add this.
Well, because it's so easy to do, in my mind, it's so easy to do. I can set up digital control stations with all the stuff still in place. I don't need to do squat. I might replace all the old, I'll refer to them, I guess, as analog enunciator windows, which are on a vertical section way up high above the board.
Okay.
And I might rip those out and put computer screens
up. Nice ones, yeah.
Screens. That's fine.
So
it's an interesting transition. It kind of concerns me. I think the stuff will work fine, but you won't know until you.
Yeah, we'll see.
Until you're actually operating the plant. It's different than a simulator.
And to that, so you and I have talked about that a lot, over the years of the state of, so American nuclear power use drastically declined or didn't grow like it was, should have, or was going to, after Three Mile Island, right?
Yeah.
Which had hype, fear, media. There was the movie, The China Syndrome, like all this, all this nuclear is going to kill you all the time.
Yep.
And over the decades, we haven't grown like France, right? Which is a huge consumer of nuclear energy, and they're not as dependent on fossil fuels.
80%. China's
ramping up tons of plants up, right? Yep. So what would you say are kind of the top two hindrances to our growth as a nuclear
politician?
Powered, yeah.
Politicians.
Gotcha. And is that based off, do you think, just not accurate information and trying to meet?
They don't know any better. They don't understand. They know people are afraid, so they're afraid to make a decision to say, I think nuclear power is good. Some of them do. Right. Don't get me wrong. You'll see some on TV says, oh, I'm a favorite nuclear power. But there's a bunch of old school ones Not so much.
Do you think I don't know how, to your point, how it would happen and be funded and all that, but kind of a national campaign or even start locally, right, around plants. And I saw right. this in emergency management. We work with Dominion and other companies to do those drills and
oh yeah,
how would sure. we decon people and all that kind of stuff. But if right. there was more kind of outreach and education and then, you know, more advertising basically for nuclear power, which you don't see as much,
right.
You know, as like gas, you see a lot of, right. They have a pretty strong marketing
yeah.
campaign going on, but it seems like from a let's get the word out. Or do you think companies look at that as wasted money because it's not going to be approved per policy and politicians anyway? Right.
Well, yeah. Well, that's the deal. See, I could you can promote it all you want, but unless right. it's sincere,
yeah,
from the heart, says, you know, we really need this technology. It's a national security issue. It's if you're really concerned about the environment, it's important right. to the environment. And not only that, something we didn't get into much. We're talking about the spent fuel a little bit. Mm-hmm. There's still 95% of the energy left in that fuel.
Wow.
So we shouldn't be burying it in the mountain.
Yeah.
We should. France reprocesses fuel, recovers the uranium. They, you need a special facility for it, obviously, because it's right. really radioactive stuff. And they reuse it. Jimmy Carter killed that because he was concerned about nuclear proliferation.
Right.
Well, to give you a feel,
this happened.
A fuel assembly is 12, 13 feet tall. It's about 8 by 8 inches. And once it's been in that reactor, the radioactivity will probably kill you in about 2 minutes.
Wow.
So you're not going to go grab one of those
go and steal it
in your pickup truck.
Right.
Because you'll be dead before you ever get to your destination. And not right. only that, physically, people don't understand this. These things weigh about 1,300 pounds. That's the other problem. Geez. No human's going to lift it by itself. And they need to be handled vertically. Structurally, they're not made, unless you got to support the complete length of the fuel assembly, they're not made to be handled horizontally.
Oh, wow.
They will fall apart. Because the way it works is you got a top nozzle and a bottom nozzle, and there's 21 tubes that connect those two nozzles.
Right.
But the fuel pins are hanging from those tubes by friction. They're called grid straps.
Huh.
Okay. So the way that works is before you put the top nozzle on, you insert the fuel pins in those grid straps. The grid straps have four little dimples on the inside, and there's seven of them along the length of the fuel assembly. And so that pin is held in there by friction. And neither end of that fuel pin touches the top or bottom nozzle. Now, why do you think that is? Well, when metal heats up, it expands.
Oh,
and when it pulls down, it contracts. So if you fasten the ends to those top nozzles and bottom nozzle, when it heated up, it'd make a big banana.
Make it a big battery.
Well, it physically, it would turn into a big banana. It can't expand, right? It would just bend.
Wow.
Pretty ingenious design, if you think about it. So those pins can expand and contract and not get out of shape, not make a bow or an arch, right? Because they're anchored at both ends.
So the thought that I'm going to sneak up into a fuel place, make a little suitcase bomb is nonsense.
No, not going to happen. Right. Not unless you're willing to die. Have a ball.
Go for it. There are some, but to your point, physically, like that's not going to happen. You're not going to sit there and chip away a piece of it.
No, nobody's just going to go grab some fuel assemblies and make a bomb. Ain't going to happen.
What would be your strategy to get U.S. nuclear power back on track? Let's say you have that politician, whoever's in charge, you're like, okay, let's do it.
Well, I want to do it more, for lack of a better word, I guess, efficiently. For example, there's two reactors coming online in Georgia. You may have heard of the Vogtle power station. But it's clear to me they didn't apply the lessons learned in terms of building. The most costly part of doing this process is construction.
Okay.
So when you're building one of those facilities, you're burning about $2 million a day.
Wow.
$2 million a day or more.
Right.
I might be a little low on that number. So if you don't have the design done, that drags it out, right? Because the NRC's got to review whatever part of the design is not done and approve it.
Having all that stuff laid out,
and you're digging dirt and building buildings and pouring concrete and da da da. So the Vogtle plant has cost now, I think it'll end up costing twice what they projected. Wow. And you're talking billions of dollars here, billions. And it took probably at least twice as long as they projected it would take to get it in service. Hmm. That's what we used to do in the 70s and 80s.
Oh.
So what did we learn?
Gotcha.
So you got to wonder, well, what in the world were they doing? They know how we used to do it. And I will submit to you that all the design wasn't done. They were in the middle of doing stuff. And all of a sudden, these field changes show up. Oh, we got to move this pipe. We got to add this control. We got to. You're toast. You're just toast. The NRC's got to approve it. Then they got to make sure you put it in right. And you're doing stuff on the fly. And that's the worst thing in the world when you're burning that kind of money.
For that, yeah.
We ought to, Japan used to, on a routine basis, build a plant and have it in service in 5 years.
Wow.
Like clockwork. You could almost set your watch to it. Hmm. Why? Because
Six Sigma efficiency is all their
well,
stuff.
If they had a certain plant design and they wanted more of those, they just made six more. They didn't screw around with the design because I want it better, different.
This way or that way.
Does it still work, generate steam, and make power? Yeah. Okay. Build another one. Just like this one. Gotcha. First of all, we know how to do this one. Now we've done one. So the next one ought to be a little better, right? Then the next one. We don't do that here. We refuse.
So their standardization made it easier. And I mean, that is the, you know, was it Toyota or Motorola that did the Six Sigma, right? And that performance improvement, how do we become more efficient?
Right.
You know, I'd imagine when you have the same template, but you're like, hey, tweak this just a little and then, okay, keep going. But using the same plan and folks, the same teams, or, you know what I mean? That knowledge is transferred and those efficiencies. So would you then look at, you know, short of having folks mail you papers, maybe a digital survey this time, but look at like, okay, what are we doing across the country? How are we getting them ready? How do we build it? Are we using similar templates or the same so that we can put them in and kind of standardize the process across the industry?
That's it. Yeah. That's what it needs to be done. Or it's just not cost effective.
Yeah.
Look at the money it costs. The only reason I think Georgia Power didn't go bankrupt is because they have deep pockets. They got a bunch of other units running. The cost of those plants has doubled.
Wow.
And we're talking going from, I don't know, 9 or 10 billion to 13, 14, 15 billion. I don't know what the number is now.
And there's no mandate like, you know, from the DOE or NRC to say like, hey, everyone has to build it this way because it's privately funded, right? Like,
Well, the theory on the new plants was they're all standard design. To me, that means the design is totally done. Totally.
Right.
Every control circuit, every building layout, every system, it's go run this pipe. It goes a certain place, certain run. Everything is done. Gotcha. So I just take the drawings and say, okay, we need to build this building this way with this stuff in it. And here's how it goes together. We need to build this building this way. Well, probably the thing that drew it out was they got a license for a standard plant, but the digital control system really wasn't done yet. So they sold the concept. Right. Here's how our digital control system is planned to work, but they didn't have all the details done. Exactly the architecture I talked about in the how am I going to lay this out? How am I going to make sure it doesn't have single point failures, blah, blah, blah. Wasn't really done.
Pays into what you're building and how.
Well, you got to know. or the money, it goes up so fast, you lose control of the project. That's what happened. Well, they were doing the same thing in South Carolina, VC Summer. A couple companies went bankrupt. The ratepayers in South Carolina are on the hook for $9 billion, and they got no power plant.
Dang.
That's how sideways it can go.
Which, so I would imagine, in addition to hype and fear and all that stuff, financial people that have felt the financial impact are cautioned to be like, yeah, let's try this again after they lost all that money.
Well, the ratepayers, you know, they were told, said, if you just pay, we want to put some new nuclear power plants in the state. If you just pay this much extra on your bill, it will cover. Well, the project was mismanaged. They paid that extra on their bill. And now the state's in the hole $9 billion with no power plant.
Jeez.
That's the reality of it.
Right.
So at least the Vogtle project, they had enough backers and deep pockets, I guess, that they were determined they were going to get done almost. And there was a lot of fussing at them for the cost and schedule, but they were determined they were going to put those suckers online, and now they're going online, at double the cost, and probably took twice as long to build them as it should have. Wow. That was the Achilles heel of the entire nuclear industry early on. Cost way too much. We're not putting them online when we should. Not good. To give you some idea, we call Surrey the goose that lays the golden eggs.
Uh-huh.
Both those units, I think, at the time in the 70s, cost $500 million. Two units.
Wow.
North Anna, even with the delay in Unit 2 because of TMI, I think it was maybe $1.6 billion. Now you're looking at, for two units, like at Vogtle, I don't know, $17 billion, $16
billion. Wow.
And you say the golden egg because when they're working, they're putting out power, they're making money, right?
Yeah.
And that goes back to the community and everything too, right? Like, it's, you know, they invest and it makes this whole cycle that doesn't just help the company that owns the power plant, right? It helps everybody around them.
Well, there's taxes they get from that, right? And then there's, you know, every 18 months, you got to refuel the reactor and do a bunch of maintenance. So a bunch of people come in that do that kind of jobs. Work.
Yeah.
Spend all kind of money in that little town. Then they go on to the next one, but that little town does pretty good because that happens every 18 months.
That's a good point.
So
that's a good point.
It's kind of a ecosystem of sorts.
Right.
Yeah. So,
well, hey, Dad, wow. I knew a lot of the stuff, not a lot of the details, but I appreciate it. I hope the folks listening and watching appreciate this too. This more of a primer, really a bit of a primer and in-depth on nuclear power and just some of the non-nuclear specific takeaways. I know I took, in addition to what we talked about of, you know, having the right people for the job makes a big difference. And even though you have some of those book folks versus the reality operators, you find a place for both of them.
Yep.
You know, or all of them, you know, and it's not just what you're doing, but that why that's huge for everybody on your team, right? Feel like they own it and making a big deal. And, you mentioned when we talked before, you know, asking what, why and why being, is it okay that we do this? Not just like, why are we doing this?
Yeah.
And it sounds like that, unfortunately, I guess, is still a challenge, is that culture and synergy, but a big impact that you were able to make in the nuclear industry is to help make things safer and meet what sounds like that overall, you know, objective to put out good power and then keep people safe. A huge factor. So I've appreciated talking to you for the past couple of days. It's been like 5 hours and of course longer than that throughout our life. I hope everybody else has and learned a whole lot between your service, you know, to your family, to me, to the Navy, to the nuclear industry. I appreciate it. I love you. I appreciate spending the time with you.
Yeah. Love you too, son.